All right, welcome to another episode of DevOps Fundamentals. Today we're going to be talking to you about continuous deployment and release management. I'm Thiago Almeida, as from the other episodes, at NZThiago on Twitter. And I have Donovan Brown.
Hi.
Donovan, you want to introduce yourself?
Yeah, I'm Donovan Brown. I'm a senior program manager here at Microsoft. I'm responsible for DevOps on TFS and VSTS.
Great. And you can, you know, follow Donovan on Twitter there or on his blog at donovanbrown.com.
Correct.
Okay, so continuous deployment and release management, that obviously fits into the software lifecycle area of release. So we tried to cover in the other episodes where it sort of fits in continuous integration. And we also have this frame from a culture shift inside your organization all the way through to tools that you can actually use to implement some practices that are in between. So at the 100 level overview, if you think about the culture shift of getting your team to always deliver continuously, so continuous delivery, that cuts across multiple things that we talked about already. So continuous integration to make sure that your code is always up to date and built and passing unit tests, et cetera, all the way through testing, automated testing. And then now we're on the next step, I guess, which is the release management and continuous deployment. And that, of course, for us here at Microsoft, it maps into Visual Studio Team Services and the release management tools that we're going to see today.
Correct.
All right, so do you want to give us your take on continuous deployment?
Yeah, continuous deployment is the ability for us to use CI, then trigger a deployment of that code. So the goal is, as soon as a developer checks in code, we don't want them to have to lift a finger for that code to be built, to be tested, to be packaged, and then be deployed into an environment for them, right? So it's all effortless. So this animation will give you that type of, you're looking at how the code gets committed to a repo, and it can be centralized or distributed, which is nice about VSTS. We don't make you choose. So if you want centralized version control, you can use it with TFVC. If you prefer Git and distributed version control, that's fine as well. And then what we're going to do is we're going to compile it, we're going to build it, and we're going to package it for you in whatever format's necessary. And then that's going to basically tell the environment, hey, there's something that you need, and release management is going to say, okay, let me grab that and actually start deploying it for you into your environment.
Cool.
Yep. So the way that you mature continuous deployment to release management is continuous deployment is usually to one environment. It's usually dev, right? A dev wants to have that quick, what we call inner loop, to where yeah, it works on my machine, but I sure would like to be able to quickly vet that this is going to work on an external machine that I don't own that might not have all the dependencies on it and allow me to find those quick failures. So that's what we want continuous deployment for.
Right.
But and I might do that before I commit to even the main repo, before I do that merge into master, so that I can say, okay, does my code actually work on an environment that's not my own? Okay, good. Now I want to go ahead and check this in and start that true workflow that's going to take my code from development all the way through into production. So again, we're going to take that packaged output, and we're not only going to deploy it to dev, but we're going to have gates, which we'll show you inside a release management demo here, of ways of going back in and not only deploying it, but testing it.
Mm-hmm.
And then waiting for approvals from individuals in your organization or groups to say, does the code look good in dev before we go ahead and promote that into staging and then finally, hopefully, from staging into production.
Right.
So that's what we're going to do is we're going to kind of grow up the continuous deployment story into release management.
Mm.
And one other note about continuous deployment, you can actually do that with our build system alone.
Yeah.
Right. Our build system actually has the ability to compile your code, run your unit test, and then deploy it to, for example, an Azure web app or to another artifact or to repository. And then what we do is, now that that's done, we need to take that and start releasing it down the pipeline.
So like the other episodes we have, if you look at the on the right side here of the slides, we do have the value propositions, the business values that you can get from this, and of course, different measurements that you can have as well, because that applies to the other DevOps culture change that we have is to measure everything. So this is one of the, you know, some of the measurements that you can have when you're doing release management across multiple environments.
Absolutely. Meantime to remediation. So as soon as we find that there's a problem, how quickly can we get a fix, not only corrected, but actually back out into that environment? So that's an MTTR. Obviously, how frequently can we get that value to our customers? Because that's the goal, right? The goal is to continuously deliver value to our end users. And we can actually measure how long it took us to have an idea before that idea actually was in the hands of our end users, right?
Cool.
So that's the kind of stuff that we definitely want to be able to measure with release management and these type of pipelines.
And if you've been following the series, you will hopefully be connecting the dots now that we've covered continuous integration, we've covered testing, and now we're going to do the next stage of deployment and release management into environments.
Absolutely. Cool. Looks like it's time for a demo, so let's go ahead and switch over. And what we have here is the landing page that you're going to get when you go to release management.
Right.
And the first thing that we do is we give you an overview of all of the pipelines that you currently have in flight. And what I like about this screen is that it's a graphical representation, and it lets me know immediately what I have in dev, what I have in staging, and what I have in production. As you can see, release 27 is already in production. And clearly we have release 28 that hopefully has some new features, maybe some bug fixes in it, trying to make its way from dev all the way through to production.
Yeah, I made some changes earlier on to the code, so it got deployed to the dev stage.
Absolutely. So we were able to wire this system up, and I'll show you how you do that, how you connect this to our build system. So you get true continuous delivery to where you don't have to, okay, the build's done, now let me go find some tool and click some buttons. All you have to do is check in your code, sit back and relax, and let VSTS build it, test it, package it, and then give it to release management, who will then go and deploy it, test it, and then move it down the pipeline for you. So this is great. You'll notice that this one is a different color, and it also has this little icon here. This is letting the system know that we've kind of paused your deployment. And well, the reason that we paused it is because we're waiting on an individual or a group to come in and give their approval that the code can then move from one stage to the next. And if we go ahead and click on this, as we'll see, is that they're waiting on me. Right, so I have to come in here and evaluate the code and say, okay, do I believe that the code is actually ready to enter the staging environment?
Right.
This is really, really powerful concept. Just imagine that you're a QA lead at an organization who runs a really exhaustive QA cycle that might be, let's say, 2 weeks long. Your development team hopefully is building code far more regularly than every 2 weeks. And as a QA lead, that doesn't mean that I want every single release that comes from the development team. Because if I'm in the middle of a 2-week QA cycle, I can't take new code until I'm done, otherwise it invalidates all my test results.
Yep.
I have to start all my testing over, and I still gotta get 28 out, so I can't take 29 at the moment. So this pre-deployment approval allows me to have that opportunity to say, you know what, I'm not ready for this code right now. Let me go ahead and finish what I'm doing, and then I'll come back and I'll approve that so that you can go ahead and deploy the code when it's time. So
and this is, of course, a choice. You don't have to have those approvals in between.
Absolutely,
the
absolutely correct.
It's up to you how confident you are with the automated test that you have. If you have a QA team that needs to manually go and test things or double check that it's running well, then that's what the approvals is there for.
Absolutely, and you can choose on a environment by environment basis on where the approvals happen or if they happen at all. So for example, in dev environments, I'm usually pretty liberal. I'm like, hey, get the code into dev as quickly as we possibly can and get it out of dev as quickly as we possibly can. So I normally don't have approvers there.
Yeah.
There is a chance that I'll put a post deployment approval because we actually have approvals at two different points in time. We have one before we touch your environment, almost like asking permission. Can I please put this code on your environment? And until you say yes, we won't touch your environment. Then we also give you an opportunity to say, should we now go to the next environment? Should we even go and try to get into production? And this is another example where I put my QA lead not only as the approver coming in, but also as the approver going out. Because if I have to stop and do some functional testing, do some exploratory testing, and I just find a huge list of issues, I don't want this code to even bother the guys who have to approve production. I want to go ahead and stop this code right now and say, this code is not of the quality in which we are going to put our name on, and then I can reject it and the code will just stop right there and not even inundate the people in production. Because there's a lot of emails going on, there's lots of alerts happening, and there's no point and having it go to production and then me having to get on a phone or email someone really quick, please, please reject that, right? Because I don't want it to go. It gives you the complete control. Now, I'm actually not going to approve this because I haven't seen the app, right? So I don't want to go
don't
and say it's
me.
Exactly. So we're going to go and look around and see if I can look at the status of this release and see if I can get some confidence on if I think it's worth being approved or not. So what we're going to do here is we're simply going to go ahead and look at release 28. And what I've done by clicking on that link is it's brought me to basically a more detailed status of what's going on with my particular release. On this page, I can see exactly what build it was originated from. And if I wanted to, I can click on this build. Might as well.
One thing that I find quite interesting is this, once you have a build, the one that you're showing here, then that is the same code that gets deployed across the environment.
So important. That is such an important concept. I've met customers who every time they want to go to a different environment, recompile their code.
Right.
That's a no-no, right? Because lots of things can happen,
right?
You never know what might be introduced. Someone might have checked in code. Maybe they went and did something to the code. Where when you rebuild it, it's really not the same zeros and ones that you just blessed in this other environment. The whole point of taking the same code is that we run an exhaustive series of tests against these exact bits, right? So I know that these zeros and ones are good, and those are the only zeros and ones I want to move forward. I do not want to recompile that. I even take this best practice with me when I start doing Docker deployments as well.
Right.
I build my image once, and I store it in, for example, Docker Hub.
Yep.
And it's that image that I'm moving to each individual containers. I don't rebuild my images as I move from container to container. I use configuration to be able to make them change and behave differently. So that's a very good point. This is the code that we're moving from one environment to the next. And as you can see here, our build has a lot of good information. You must have talked about this in your continuous integration talk about the test and the code coverage. But it's nice to see that we build that traceability into our product to where easily from my release, I can jump to the build that actually triggered it, and then I can find some more information about that build. Maybe as a QA lead, if a lot of these are failing or your code coverage is really low or dipped, maybe I don't have the confidence to move the code forward. So it's nice to have it at your fingertips.
So like you saw there were 37 tests that passed, so that was good, and those were all unit tests that we have in the Parts Unlimited Simple.
Correct.
You can create a lot more, of course, in there and make sure that you have a lot more code coverage, but that would give the approver or the QA guy a better overview of how your build has happened.
Absolutely. So here, as we can see, we're going to be going through three different environments. One's called Dev, Staging, and Production. We're currently through Dev, we did that 2 hours ago, and now we're basically sitting here waiting on me to go back in and approve it, so it's pending right now. And we give you the duration of each one of these different stages of our deployment, and it also it's calculating the time it's taking me to go ahead and approve it as well, right? Because that's wasted time. And when we go back and we're trying to look at what our lead time is, on how long does it take for me to commit code before it ends up into an environment, we can go back and point the finger at Donovan's like, you were the approver and it took you like 3 days to approve that change. What were you doing? Why did it take so long? So that we can go back in and fix that problem as well.
And that goes back to that other practice we talked about measuring everything.
Everything.
This is one thing that you can measure is how long has it taken for someone to approve
exactly
a stage.
Absolutely. Obviously, we'll give you some outputs for the deployment that we've already done successfully. And as you can see here, we're starting to aggregate some test results.
Right.
So not only can we run tests during our build, which you should, but you should also go around, turn around and run more tests in your release because the types of tests that you're able to run are different.
Yeah.
When you're just compiling code and it hasn't been deployed yet, you can run unit tests. Mm. Run your code in isolation with no external dependencies and get some good idea that they work the way they're supposed to individually. Now that we've actually deployed the code, we can actually start doing a lot more exhaustive, what we call integration testing, making sure that when I manipulate the front end, that data makes it all the way to the database. And then I can retrieve that data back, that the tracer bullet, like I like to call it, is actually working. All of our entire pipeline is working. Not only can we do functional testing like Selenium or Coded UI, I can go back in, I can do manual and exploratory, but we can even run load test during these environments as well, so that we can use Azure for cloud-based load testing to go and make sure that not only does it function, but it performs the way we want it to perform as well all throughout your pipeline. And we're going to go into details on exactly how we can configure that stuff. This is an extensible model too, so you can go back in and you can actually add your own sections to this as an external part, which I like to point out. Our build and our release system are very highly extendable. I've been working really hard on a Docker extension that has a lot of different Docker tasks that I'm going to be adding to the system that perform really well in the scenarios that I need it to be. And as you can see here, I'm being reminded again once more, hey, Donovan, we're waiting on you, right? So we try to make sure that you don't have to go to a specific page to get that approval. I was also sent an email that says, hey, Donovan, we're waiting on you again, right? So the system is very aware of we need you to come in here and take some action so that we can keep moving our pipeline across. So we're going to go ahead and leave that for now. And we're going to go look at what we call environments. Now, I'm really touchy on the term environment. I have a series on release management, and I've been harping on the product team, so I'll go ahead and get on my soapbox real quick. I wish we would call this something different, right? Because I don't think of them as environments.
Right.
I think of them as logical groupings of a series of tasks that I want to perform that I might want approvals before or after. That is it, right? Because if I literally wanted to perform these tasks on 10 different machines across all my environments, there's nothing technically stopping me from doing it in this environment. If I wanted to deploy, for example, just my web app in one of these environments, and then my database in another environment because right. I want my DBA to come in and do an approval before I do push that change. Yeah. There's no reason that I cannot split that across multiple of these logical environments.
So you could have, going from what you mentioned, you could have a dev web and a dev database, and they both look at the same source of that came off of the CI.
And also are targeting the same physical hardware, right? The same physical environment. Because when most of us think of an environment, in our head we imagine machines to which we're going to deploy our code on. Mm. And we have a set of machines for dev, and we have a set of machines for QA, and we have a set of machines for production, right? And when I think of this, a lot of our customers are saying, okay, whatever I want to do in dev, I have to do it all in this block. And that's not true.
Not really.
As you just described, right? We can name these whatever we want to name these. Yeah. And it could be dev stage one, dev stage two, dev stage three, whatever you want it to be called, right? So I just want to make sure that's clear. Please don't lock yourself into everything that I do has to be done in one environment at one time. This is completely flexible. You can do whatever you'd like to do in it as well. So actually, I'm going to back out. Right now, I'm looking at an existing release. So there's certain things that are going to be locked down and read only. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to back up. And I'm actually going to edit the definition, not the actual run itself. Mm-hmm. That'll give me a little bit more flexibility. For example, it'll allow me to change the name of this, should I choose to do that. And it also allows me to add more tasks. I think one of the greatest things about our system is that the task library that we have available to you is just fantastic. Mm. And I always get a kick out of bringing this up, because when I do, when I go to all, the majority of the stuff on here has nothing to do with Microsoft. Mm. Traditionally, you would not expect Microsoft to be helping you do Android native development or iOS development. We can also help you deploy those things with things that we have Ant and Maven. So this list is really, really long of information that you normally wouldn't associate with Microsoft, but it is a new Microsoft, right? Mm. We've been saying that a lot.
And you can create your own tasks as well, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. I have created so many of these, and the more I create, the more I want to create, because it's so easy to do, and I get ideas of what I want the task to do for me, and they become building blocks for you to build whatever pipeline that you want. One thing I like to point out whenever I talk about this system is this utility tab. Mm. The mantra is this, it's very simple. If you can show me a command line, I can do it from my build and my release system, period. And when I say period, it's because if you come down here to the bottom, we have a shell task, which includes Linux and Macs as well. So it's not just Windows machines I'm talking about. It's not just PowerShell and a command or a batch file. It's also bash scripts and things like that that we can use to be able to deploy our applications in our to our targets. So I always preach any language, any platform. And any platform includes iOS, Android, it includes Windows Phone, whatever it is that you need to deploy to, because we have integration with the Hockey app and things like that as well. So we have you covered from a mobile DevOps perspective just as well. So big fan of our task library. I write lots of my own custom tasks. And another thing that's really cool about it, the reason that I write so many of them is because our task library is open source. So every one of these is in GitHub, and you can go and see exactly how they wrote theirs so that you can then use it to write your own, which is how I learn most of this stuff. So it's pretty cool. Again, you can define environments. Many environments, when you define them, are going to be similar to the environment that came before it. And we try to make that very efficient by simply allowing you to clone an environment, making it really easy for you to duplicate an environment. And then you can come back in that environment and just simply twiddle the values here. Mm. Normally targeting a different environment, maybe changing an environment variable or something to that effect.
Yeah, that's how we created the staging and production ones is we first defined we created the dev one, and then I just cloned it. And in the staging, we just added load testing as well, but that's the only difference.
Right.
Everything else was similar. And of course, the variables for each environment.
Correct. The things that I don't mind changing, whenever I'm thinking of a DevOps pipeline, the two items I don't mind changing are what I call scale and configuration. Mm. What I mean by that is that in dev, sometimes I will deploy all of my application to one physical server. The database, the middle tier, and the front end are all there because it's just for my convenience and my quick vetting. But when I go to QA, the scale is different because I have, say, I have a dedicated database server, I have a dedicated middle tier server, and I have a dedicated front end or web server. So the scale has changed, but the tasks that I'm going to perform are the same. I'm going to deploy my database, I'm going to deploy my front end, I'm going to deploy my middle tier. In dev, I happen to be talking to the same machine, but in QA, I happen to be talking to individual machines. Now, upgrade that into production. Production, the scale could even be bigger. Databases are clustered. We have things that are clustered together for the middle tier. So what I'm doing, again, is exactly the same. I'm deploying my database, my middle tier, and my front end, but the scale in which I'm deploying it has changed. And obviously the configuration, right?
Yeah.
Where my database lives in dev is different than it is in QA than it is in prod. And the applications need to know that. So I will change my configuration, and I might change my scale, but I don't try to change a lot of what I'm doing in each of my environments.
So in the Parts Unlimited demo that we have been using throughout the episodes, you can see there we have an Azure resource group that we deploy with the details about it. And it's the same ARM template that we use across all three, just different parameters as far as scale and admin passwords and et cetera.
Correct. And also, I see that you're using a PowerShell, kind of proving anything that you can do. I'm assuming you're doing this for your swapping of the tasks.
Swap, yes.
Exactly.
I could have used your
absolutely.
Your
you could have.
Task,
yep.
Yes,
you could have written your own task, which is what I did, to where I just simply put in the to and from slots, mm-hmm. and it handles the rest for me because I'd written this PowerShell. And I knew I was going to need the PowerShell more than once. The only downside to doing a PowerShell is that the PowerShell has to be in your repo.
Yeah.
Right. So that it can be accessible because here you have to give it the path to the repo. And I knew that this was reusable PowerShell. Mm-hmm. So I just wrapped it in my own task, added the task to my system, and now I have a task that does the swap for me. Mm-hmm. So it's really nice that there's no wrong answer. Right. If this is more convenient, then the system is flexible enough to let you do that. Other things I like to point out when we're talking about environments are those approvers. So as you can see here, we have the checkbox for automated. That means we're telling the system it's safe for you to enter dev at any time that you have a new build, and it's safe for you to leave dev every time that you're ready to leave dev without any approvers. Now, if we were to go back and look at our staging one, it's going to be slightly different. I am the person that they've chosen to be the approver of entering this particular stage, and until I say it's okay, the code will sit there indefinitely waiting for me to approve it.
Yep.
Now, what's nice is what if I've gone on vacation? That would be bad. Mm. Right, so you're not going to get this thing approved until I come back from vacation. What you can do instead of putting an individual is actually you can put a group there.
A group of people.
Exactly. Yeah. And then anyone in that group has the authority to move your code further down the pipeline. So it doesn't have to be that one individual person, which is really nice as well. As you said, you can have it for entering and exiting the environment. And it can be any combination of individuals and or groups.
Right.
So if you were to put four groups, then four individuals, any one person from each group would have to come in and give their thumbs up, and then the code would finally move along.
Cool.
Yeah, very powerful stuff. I actually quite like it. There's also the ability to configure variables, because there's some variables that are going to be different for dev than they are for QA than they are for production. As you can see here, clearly we have a lot of dev-named resources and variables that we're going to be using. Mm-hmm. And if we were to switch over to QA, those same variables are going to be available to us, but obviously they're going to be in stage or the name of the task that we're moving forward to.
Yeah, and we also have the admin password for the database. So Parts Unlimited, half of it is a web app that gets deployed to an Azure web app, and the other part is a SQL database.
Okay.
So we use the admin password from here that gets passed into the resource group step.
Perfect.
And then it creates a database with that password and then takes that and creates a connection string to the web app.
Great.
So just by setting it here, it actually goes out, creates the environment if it's not there already, and makes sure that the web app has a connection to the database and the app can start running.
Great. And I also like the fact that you can encrypt this data.
Yeah.
So a password's not something you'd want in plain text.
Exactly, yeah.
And a lot of people use the same password for several of their databases. And what's really nice here as well is we actually have variables at two different levels.
Right.
One of them is down here at the environment level, but we also have configuration up here to where you can define a variable to which is going to be the same across all of your environments. Mm. So you don't have to define it multiple times. So if any of those values were the same, you could actually elevate it to a higher level, set it once, then have it apply to all of them. Mm. Go ahead.
One that I almost used here was the website name.
Okay.
So, or if you want to give a part of the site name that goes in here, and then you can use that throughout the environments and just put the environment extension at the end.
Absolutely.
So stage or dev.
Yep. And another thing that's interesting here is that if you were to define a variable here, let's say, for example, your dev and QA admin passwords were the same, clearly your production is not. Mm-hmm. You could actually define your password here that would automatically apply to dev and QA, but then in the production, redefine it, and then whatever you do in that production environment will overwrite the value that we have here globally. So
with
it gives you a way to have the same. Yep, exactly.
Cool.
Yep, so it's kind of nice to be able to do it both ways. And then finally, I'm sure you talked about, or correct me if I'm wrong, did you talk about the agents and how they work
not
in your
yet.
CI?
No.
So our agents are really interesting because the same agent works for continuous integration that works for release management. So they're the same agent. It uses the same task library. So you don't have to learn something different. For those who have already seen the episode on continuous integration, you should look very familiar, everything that I'm showing you here, because they're built off the same architecture. And I think that, I mean, it's great because it's by design that once you've spent time with our build system, you're immediately comfortable with our release system.
Yep.
We add a few new concepts like approvers and environments, but other than that, all the concepts are the same. Now, when you have an agent actually has certain capabilities associated with it. And those capabilities allow you to determine what you can or cannot build on that particular agent. So for example here, if we were to go to hosted and click on capabilities, we'll be able to see all the different types of technologies which its item can build for us. These are called capabilities. And we're going to map these capabilities to the demands of our particular build or release. If you were to have your own here, and the reason that a lot of people do have their own build agents is because they need some technology that simply is not hosted on our hosted agent. You might need Wix for your installers, or you might need a newer version of Azure PowerShell that's not on a hosted agent. You can spin up your own private agent and then add whatever capabilities that you want to that particular agent, which is really powerful. I just started doing that with some of my my Linux. So, because I create several different pools, and I have a pool for all my Linux agents, right? Mm-hmm. And I install all the capabilities on there as well. So what we do is we take those capabilities, we map them against these demands, and that helps the system figure out which of those agents should I use that matches the demands that we have here.
And that must be pretty handy for a large team with multiple feature teams and different requirements for different build agents.
Absolutely.
So you can create different pools for the dependencies that each team needs for their build system and release system.
Yep.
And then just map it.
Yep, because you get to choose which pool of agents you want to pull from. So you have a couple options there. You can go ahead and say, I would like to group all of my Linux and Macs and PCs differently, mm-hmm. or you can literally put them all in the exact same pool, and based on the capabilities and the demands, we'll know that, oh, this one requires that it run on a Linux machine, or this one requires it runs on a Mac, so that you don't have to have multiple pools, but you give you that flexibility to create them should you need them. Yeah, good point.
Cool.
Yep, and then what else do we have under here? Obviously, we talked about cloning. You can save these as templates. So if this series of tasks are a series that you envision having to use multiple times in several different pipelines, you don't have to rebuild it from hand by scratch every single time. And even when you add a new environment, we actually have templates that you can use to actually determine what type of environment do you need to create. One that does an Azure Cloud Service, one that's deploying an Azure web app, a website. Well, they're actually called web apps now.
Yeah.
We need to update that. Or do you just want to have an empty one that you can start from scratch and go ahead and build to your heart's content? So it's really nice stuff there as well. Now, another thing that's really important is once you build your environments, you have your approver set up and you have all the tasks, what are we actually deploying? Where do we pick up the actual bits that we're going to actually deploy? And that's through what we call an artifact. An artifact is the output of a build that has everything bundled into it, like the web app, the test cases that I need, and any other artifacts that we need to be able to successfully deploy your application. What's really nice is that we don't just work with our build system. We also work with things like Jenkins. So for all of our customers that are watching who are already using Jenkins, you don't have to switch to our build system. Mm. You might want to evaluate it again, and you might want to switch to our build system. Our build system now is really, really good. But you can stay in Jenkins, and actually we can actually pick up that build from Jenkins and actually start deploying it down our release pipeline for you. If you're using TFS on-prem, we consider that basically team build external.
Right.
We can still go and grab those outputs for you and actually deploy them down the pipeline for you. And obviously, if you're using VSTS for your build, you would just simply use build. And you can add as many artifacts as you'd like. Mm-hmm.
So that's the build that we covered in the continuous integration. Yep. So it basically, whenever that build runs and creates an output and it's successful, then it shows up here for release management to deploy.
Absolutely. And what's really nice is that they talk to each other. We've already talked about configuration, so I'll skip over that and go to triggers. And this is where we've basically told release management, I would like you to watch that build over there. And every time that build finishes, I want you to start running whatever output it produced for us. And that's exactly what we're doing here. So they were doing true continuous deployment. So again, just imagine a developer checks in code, and moments later, that code is actually running on an environment. And that's what we're going to be able to enable for you here. We have a three-stage deployment here, dev, staging, and production. Not every build do you want to go to production every single time, especially when you're doing a lot of CI builds. If your CI builds are going through here, you might want them to stop in dev or maybe stop in staging. And then I individually cherry pick that's the one that I want to go to production based on its code coverage, based on our test results, based on its performance of our web performance testing. Of these five, that's the one that I want. So you don't have to inundate production with all these builds if you don't want to. You can actually say, I want you to stop at staging with every deployment, and then I'm going to come back in and promote whichever one that I want to production.
Cool.
Which is what I do on one of my sites, because I use this stuff, right? And I have a production site that's every single time I check in code, it is deployed. But then I come in and decide, do I want to go ahead and swap that over into production or not? Finally, generals, not much on here today. It basically gives you a naming format for our releases.
Right.
And then we basically support the same history that we supported in our build system and our release system as well. So again, everything that you learned in our build episode, all of that is true in the release episode here that we're talking about today, but just the concept of environments and approvals. So let's go back real quick and take a look at the releases that we had. No, we don't need to keep any of those changes. This is another view of the same information, right? So this is a releases view of all the releases that we've done over the course of a period of time, quick links to the build, and obviously that another reminder that this is all my fault. So let me go ahead and approve this and say, looks good. And let's see what happens when I approve this. So when I go ahead and approve this, what should happen is the system should wake up and say, okay, it's time for me to start moving this. And if I were to go over to our log section here, you'll see that we have real-time logs for even your releases, so that you can see and monitor in real time exactly what's happening on those agents and where we are in your deployment. So if something's taking a really long time, you don't have to wonder if it's frozen or not. You can come in here and actually see the output in real time. You can go back anytime that you'd like to and obviously review the output of previous actions that have already been taken.
Right.
And we also give you two other things when you're looking at a review, the ability to look at work items. TFS has always been good at traceability, VSTS is as well. When you're working on code and you have the work item or the bug in front of you, you're able to actually commit it to a repository or source control and associate a work item to the code that you're checking in so that in the future I can go back and say, Donovan, what files did you change to fix bug XYZ? We can actually go find bug XYZ and it'll show me every time I checked in code and I can go and look at every line of code that I changed. When you do that, it also flows all the way into our release pipeline because I would be very curious on what bugs am I deploying right now? What features do we think are in this build that we're trying to deploy to production? And this screen will actually allow you to see all those bugs or features or change requests or whatever it is that you were working on that are actually getting deployed right now because of this particular release. And we do the same thing with commits as well.
Right.
So every check-in that's happened since the last time, and as you can see, we're basically releasing the same build over and over again here. And I can prove that because if we go back one more time to the beginning, you can look at these icons. This one was continuous deployed. Right, there is a continuous deploy of this one. This one I'm deploying right now, which means there was no code changes. I'm just releasing the same code. So in theory, if I come here and go to commits, you can see that there was a check-in that actually triggered this release.
That's a very good developer, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I heard great things about this guy. Great things about him. I don't know if they're all true or not, but I've heard a lot of great things. And again, echoing the whole traceability, right? Being able to effortlessly move from my release into the code that actually changed, that actually caused this particular release. So again, we're working really hard to make sure that there's just this one pane of glass. I mean, if you were to go back 2 years ago and do the same demo, I would have taken you inside of Visual Studio, I would have taken you to a web browser, I would have taken you into Microsoft Test Manager, I would have had to take you into release management, and now we give you all that information at your fingertips right through a web browser.
Cool.
Yeah.
And do you want to show the Azure portal where the deployments are?
Sure, we can go back in there. Actually, I think you're going to have to log in here because you're going to be using your Azure account to deploy to there, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so let's go ahead and swap sides real quick, and then we'll let you drive for that section.
We'll be right back. All right, so we swapped places now, and I just signed into my Azure subscription. So to remind you, with the definition here of the Parts Unlimited one, we have the three environments. And for dev, we have a resource group deployment that's deploying to a website called website name. So you can see there at the bottom. And that's just configured here as configurable variable that Donovan showed called DevOps, Fund, Web, and Dev. And also the resource group is called resource group. So that's another configuration variable here that we have. And we called it DevOps, Fund, Dev. So whenever we're deploying to the staging slot on the web app for that resource group. So if we go to DevOps Fund Dev here, we'll see everything that got deployed as part of the ARM template. That's a database server, and a website called DevOps Fund Dev Web Dev, and its staging slot. So whenever we deploy, it gets deployed to the staging slot. And I'll browse to that here. And that's just the Parts Unlimited solution that we've been playing with. And you can see here the discount is 30% on the homepage, because that was the change that I made that you approved.
Okay.
And
I should have verified that before you approved it. 30% sounds like a lot.
Yeah, too much discount. But if we go to production here, we'll have the same solution deployed in a completely different resource group. And you, of course, you can configure different scales like we mentioned and et cetera. So once we go through staging, it goes through the testing and the cloud-based web performance testing, and then we do the site swap. And once that gets approved, it goes to production. So what we have in production here on the production website, if I browse to that, is the same website, but with the, it should still have the previous version of the discount.
Sure.
So it's not that big a discount. I think it's only 25%.
Okay.
So let that load while I show the release that we have. You can see it failed here, so there must have been something wrong. We got rejected.
So, if we go ahead and look at the logs, go to the far right for me under logs. And what this is going to do is it's going to give us a detailed report of exactly what happened. And it looks like we had some issues with our test assemblies here. So
one test failed probably, and then it rejected that. And it's not going ahead with the deployment.
Right, and there's a couple of things that we can do there. You can actually say that if the test fails, I want you to abandon everything, which I obviously would do if there was a automatic like moving forward to back.
Yeah.
But you can also say, I don't want you to fail my release just because some tests failed.
Right.
You can also say, I want you to continue anyway. And I might do that if I have a approver on the outside who can go back and say, okay, is that just a flaky test that we need to go back and reevaluate? Okay. Was it an environment issue that caused that test to fail? So it's just kind of nice to have that flexibility again to be able to say, if any tests fail, I want you to fail my release. Because I have an automatic exit. Or I can say, regardless if they fail or not, I want you to continue because I have someone there that's going to take care of it for me.
So in the definition, that would be, say, for example, here, that would be continue on error.
Is exactly. That is correct. And that one would allow it to continue even if some of your tests were to fail as well. So it's up to you.
Cool.
So I just like the fact that it allows you to quickly find that. And another thing that you could do is if it was a flaky test, which obviously is a bad thing, we need to go fix that, you could easily restart that pipeline, right? You can go back to say, hey, okay, it failed going through stage. Let's just restart it and see if it was something flaky. And it'll attempt to go through that again, including requiring me to approve the restart of your pipeline.
Okay, so we could go into here and restart.
Yep. And what it'll do is it's going to immediately go back to the point to where Donovan has to approve it. See?
Okay.
So as you can see, the little icon shows up there.
Right.
And I think you're an admin, so you should be able to go ahead and...
Oh, we're still logged in as you.
Oh, you are? Oh, perfect. So you can go ahead and try it again. You can just say, try again.
Awesome code.
Yeah, so awesome that it failed the first time.
Yeah. Didn't even pass the test.
Exactly, exactly.
So we'll kick that off again.
And we'll see how we get, if we make any progress.
But the main thing I wanted to show you is that because the way that we're doing this, we're looking after the environment, deploying into it, and running tests, in the end, we end up with three different environments here on Azure. Defined as different resource groups, and then inside of each we have a staging slot, and that's something that you and I discussed quite a lot before, is that you deploy to the staging slot and then you do a little site swap so that there's no downtime on the deployment.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I remember the first time that I got introduced to deployment slots, I was like, oh, this is going to be awesome. I'm simply going to have like seven slots on my website and I'm just going to swap my way into production. And if you think about that, the way that we actually do deployment, it's a very dangerous thing to consider, right? Because this is a perfect example. It's almost like we planned this. Restarting a stage. Let's say, for example, that I had I just wanted to go and swap my way into production. So what we would have done is we would have simply swapped dev to QA or dev to stage. That would have been our action. Now, when we restart it, what would we actually be doing? We'd be taking what we really want and swapping it back out, which would not be what we were trying to do when we restart a stage.
Yeah.
That's why what you do in a stage has to be identical. So what we did here is we copied the files that we wanted to the staging slot, which no one can see, and then we went and ran tests on it. And the beautiful thing is none of our end users are even aware that we're doing this. And none of them were impacted by the bad code because we never swapped it into the live slot that they were seeing. And what's also nice about that is if the test had passed, we would have swapped it. It would have been zero downtime deployment. Because when you're copying, for example, an ASP.NET application, during the copy, we actually take the site down for a moment. Right? It has this little catch-all HTML page that says the site's being updated. Yeah. We'll be right back. But at that time, your customers are no longer able to use your site. And only in a demo does that happen very, very quickly.
Yeah.
Real sites are relatively large, takes a while to copy, and at that period of time, you're no longer making money, your customers are unhappy. But with the deployment slots, I can take as long as I need to deploy to that staging slot. And once it's done, at a push of a button, it swaps it into production with zero downtime. And I love the way that we've added it to our pipelines here, because we're able to go back in, do some quick smoke test, and say, oh man, this has no reason to make its way into production. But you want to do the swap in every single slot, not just swap your way into production.
That's cool. Yeah, and also, because we're running the load test on the staging slot, on the staging environment itself, completely separate from production, then we can load test it as much as we like.
That's a great point.
We can test out, scale out, and scale back in without annoying any customers.
Exactly. And then I think the point he's making there is that all slots of the same web app exist on the same physical hardware, which means you never want to actually do load testing on the staging slot of your actual production website, because you're loading that entire physical machine. So its network is going to be impacted, its memory is going to be impacted, even though you think you're on a different slot because they share the same machine. So you would never want to run load test on a slot that's hosting your production website.
Yep.
Because it impacts everyone.
Yeah, so this production one the depends on this app service plan that you can then define how big or small you want, and then the other two have their own service plan as well.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Yep. But they look identical, which is great.
Yeah.
So that if I need to restart it, I know that I'm going to get the same end result every time I restart my stage. And that was a lesson I learned the hard way. I have this best practices deck that I'll do every once in a while. And the sad thing is that every slide is a reminder of something that I did wrong at one point.
Cool.
Great.
All right. Look like the
test. We're getting a little further. Yeah, we're getting a little further.
The test passed.
So we might have a flaky test there, right? Yeah. So we have to go back and do some evaluation on why
double
it failed
check
the first
why.
Time. Yeah. Exactly, exactly.
That is running some Selenium tests.
Okay.
So it might have been something to do with the browser or the way that the test was written for that specific one.
Potentially.
So
potentially.
I'll look into it.
And you're using a hosted build agent, if I'm not mistaken. So you're using the Phantom driver.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah. And of course, if you want to run then Chrome and others, then you would go with your own.
Exactly. That's how I do all my demos. Mm-hmm. I want to run against actual Chrome and against actual Firefox. So what I did is I stood up several of my own private agents, which you can do. It's very simple to stand up an agent. And then I run my agent in what we call interactive mode, which makes it able to interact with the desktop and launch browsers and things like that. And what's really neat is I actually don't have Chrome on all of my agents, but I added that as a capability.
Yeah.
And then I demand on whatever environment I need to that you have Chrome, because I know I'm going to run all my tests on Chrome. And then Chrome pops up, I execute my test, and then in the next environment I might use Firefox or some other browser. So if you need the browser to actually fire up, you cannot do that on our hosted builds, because our hosted build agents don't run an interactive.
It needs the admin rights and stuff like that.
Basically, it's running as a Windows service, and our Windows service can't interact with the desktop yet.
Cool.
Very cool.
All right. So I hope that gives you a really great overview of the release management capabilities that we have. And also, of course, at the beginning, we covered the concept of release management and continuous deployment, which is part of our whole DevOps fundamentals here. The last slide, as always, we have resources besides Donovan's blog post that we covered at the beginning. We have a few. The ones that I like to call out every time is the two at the bottom. So we have the DevOps practice hands-on with Parts Unlimited apps. So that's a whole bunch of different hands-on labs that you can follow at your own pace. And we also have a series that you and David Tessar recorded called Release Management.
We've been actually partnering up quite a bit. It was funny. I saw a tweet today that said we're like the lethal weapon of DevOps, right? The two of us together. And it's always a blast, because he kind of represents the ops side of the world. And I've been a developer for 20 years. So I always come from it from a very developer-centric perspective. And when we come together, it's really like we keep each other honest on that. It's not weighted too heavily ops or too heavily dev. And it's really been a great experience working with him to get that full DevOps experience.
Cool. So check that out. It of course, expands a lot more into different things about the release management that we just gave you an overview today. And I think that's it.
It's been a pleasure.
Right.
Thanks so much
for
having me.
Yeah, thanks, guys. See you.
Take care.